Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and France 24. We will begin with Afshin Ratansi's Going Underground. Afshin interviewed Professor Stephen Walt, a political scientist currently serving as the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. In the 3 excerpts I have extracted, he begins by giving his reasons for supporting Julian Assange. He then explains why he says that Russia was provoked into invading Ukraine. He then dispels the American notion that if Ukraine does not defeat Russia, that Russia will follow by invading Western Europe. Going Underground.
Professor Stephen Walt, author of Origins of Alliances and the Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-authored with Professor John Mersheimer. He is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School and joins me now from Brookline, Massachusetts. The U.S. has given this 3 weeks. I know the case itself, the documents are labyrinthine. No one really seems to understand it. And top QCs, now KCs in Britain, have told me they've never seen anything like it. Why have you supported Julian Assange?
Well, because I don't believe Julian Assange committed espionage. He was operating much as journalists do. He received classified information that was leaked to him by people in the U.S. government. But that's no different than people leaking information to the New York Times. So to single him out as a particularly egregious case and to accuse him of espionage seems to me inappropriate. I might add that governments around the world, including the U.S. government, leak information when they want to journalists, when they're trying to advance a particular policy and they're trying to spin a story in a particular way. And given that Assange was, in my judgment, acting much in the same way that all journalists do, albeit in a different platform, to have singled him out in this way and threatened him with a long prison sentence, you know, possibly a life sentence, strikes me as just inappropriate. And if he were extradited and subsequently convicted in the United States, I think it will have a chilling effect on press freedom here in the United States, which would be unfortunate, because one of the things we expect the press to do, of course, is inform us about secrets that the government is trying to keep from us. And in particular, when those policies are going awry, the public needs to be informed about them. And of course, most journalists understand that, but if they can be thrown in jail for reporting information that is leaked to them by people inside the government, then I think it'll have a chilling effect on the rest of the media.
I know the papers of record there do support him, have written articles in favor of him, but surprised by how little attention has been given to the Assange case in the United States and for what it means for press freedom in the U.S., given that it means any conviction would open the doors to the jailing of the editor of the New York Times and the Washington Post and who knows who else?
I think part of the problem here, of course, is this case has taken a long time. It's been, you know, he's been incarcerated on various grounds. He was hiding out in the Ecuadorian embassy for many years. And in some respects, I think attention, you know, the short attention span of modern society has been such that his case has not gotten as much attention. He's been off the headlines. I believe if he is extradited, if the case goes through, he comes to the United States and he stands trial, then the case is going to get an enormous amount of attention, precisely because media organizations are going to be very worried about the implications.
Russia and China have been lockstep at the UN Security Council opposing the United States and Britain and France policy on in the Middle East. And, of course, Russia and China have been working together on the proxy war in Ukraine. Why have you insisted on calling it provoked, in a sense, in your work on Ukraine, rather than unprovoked, which is loudly shouted out almost by journalists on so-called mainstream media in your country and in NATO countries?
Again, it gets, I think, very much at the definition of what you mean by provoked. When I say the war was provoked, I mean that the United States and NATO took actions which drove Russia to ultimately decide to invade. Beginning first in 2014, of course, with the seizure of Crimea, and then full-scale war in 2022. To say that the United States took actions that helped cause that does not justify what Russia did. What Russia has done is illegal. It's a violation of international law.
You said the same thing about Kosovo, presumably in the, I think it's the 25th anniversary of Yugoslavia's destruction.
That's right. And the United States invading Iraq in 2003 was a violation of international law. So I'm not defending Russia's actions. I'm trying to explain Russia's actions. And they regarded the American attempt, along with NATO, to gradually incorporate Ukraine into the Western security order, ultimately leading to NATO membership, as an existential threat. Now, we can argue about whether or not they should have seen it that way, but the point is they did, and they made that clear from 2008 forward. And we continued on this path even when they threatened to do something about it militarily. We did not take those threats sufficiently seriously. And that, again, does not justify what Putin has done. It certainly does not justify the way they've waged the war, the attacks on civilians, what are probably war crimes eventually. None of that is justified by the fact that American policy helped bring this about. And unfortunately, we did this, and the victims, the primary victims of our diplomatic and strategic mistakes and Russia's illegal invation, are Ukrainians who are suffering.
To the last Ukrainian, as many in the Global South have observed. And the media reports in Western European media that Russia will then take over Poland and invade, I don't know, France, Macron might be trying to say. Why is this? Where is this hysteria coming from?
I think it's coming from an attempt to inflate a set of dangers in order to galvanize a European public response, and in some cases to persuade Americans to do even more. This idea that the Russian army is going to finish the job in Ukraine, rest for a couple of weeks, and then start going after the rest of Europe, I think is completely absurd. First of all, the Russian army has suffered a lot. They've experienced lots of losses in Ukraine that'll take a long time to rebuild. And second, even with a sort of 3-to-1 advantage in manpower and artillery and things like that, they're having a very tough time.
I don't think they want to, in fairness, rather than the practicality.
That's also true. So this idea that if Putin is not stopped in Ukraine and it doesn't suffer a massive defeat, that he is going to launch some blitzkrieg at Western Europe, I think is a fantasy.
Professor Stephen Walt, thank you.
Nice talking with you.
That interview is excerpted from Afshin Ratansi's twice-weekly program called Going Underground. It is available at Apple and other podcast sites, as well as at the Canadian website rumble.com, which has video as well. I highly recommend listening to the entire interview. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. First, the partial legalization of cannabis came into effect this week in Germany, with a unique plan for distribution through so-called social membership clubs. The Israeli murder of 7 international aid workers was heavily criticized across the world, which the Israeli government says was an accident. The United States NGO World Central Kitchen says that they were targeted, as were the other 190 aid workers killed so far in Gaza. The Biden administration authorized another multi-billion-dollar weapons package for Israel, including 1,800 one-ton bombs that are allegedly the source of the mass casualty events in Gaza. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Here in Germany, a new law partially legalizing cannabis has come into effect. At midnight, hundreds gathered in central Berlin to celebrate the moment. Under the legislation, over 18s can now possess up to 25 grams in public for personal use and cultivate up to 3 plants at home. But the legislation has its critics who point to health and law and order concerns. Germany's conservative opposition says they'll revoke the law if they come to power.
The new cannabis measures are only a partial legalization. So what do they mean exactly? Adults over 18 in Germany are now allowed to carry up to 25 grams of cannabis on them. They can smoke weed in public, but not within 100 meters of schools, sports facilities, or playgrounds. People can also grow up to 3 plants at home and store up to 50 grams of cannabis for personal use. For now, there won't be any shops selling it directly to customers. The only way to buy weed legally will be through a so-called cannabis social club membership, but only from July 1st.
Social clubs can have up to 500 members, and they all actively participate in the cannabis production. For each individual member, the club can grow up to 3 plants and can thus produce a member's monthly supply, which is a maximum of 50 grams, and then give it to the member.
In Berlin, people hope the new law will reduce the illegal market for the drug. While many in Germany are celebrating, some have raised concerns about the legalization. While police unions say it will be hard to enforce regulations, checks, and penalties, doctors are worried that the new law sends the wrong message and plays down the dangers of cannabis use and addiction.
I'd like to welcome Bernd Wasser, the co-founder of the Center for Drug Research at Goethe University in Frankfurt, which has been tracking this legalization process. I'd like to start with your thoughts on this new law. Do you think it does indeed play down the dangers of cannabis use and addiction, as some doctors are saying?
We have seen in other countries where they had liberalizing or even legalizing laws that it didn't come into effect. At best, older people tended to smoke more, but not younger people. So all these concerns about young people smoking more and sending the wrong message and so on, that hasn't been true in other countries, and it won't be true in Germany as well.
Do you think we could see the legalization of commercial pot production in licensed shops, for example? Would this be another possible model that Germany would work toward?
Well, that's what the German government has planned, but I didn't see any concrete efforts regarding this second pillar, the so-called second pillar of the cannabis law. And I hope that the government will set up draft laws quite soon, because otherwise they won't have a chance to get it done in this legislative term. The main thing that has changed is that millions of people are not criminalized anymore. They can smoke in public, they can carry up to 25 grams, and they won't have to be fearful against policemen when they meet them. And I think this is really a very big step in German drug policy.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. That is Bernd Wasser from the Center for Drug Research.
Growing pressure on Israel from its closest allies over a deadly attack on an aid convoy. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has urged his Israeli counterpart to take concrete steps to protect aid workers and Palestinian civilians, and called for a quick and transparent investigation. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has criticized Israel's explanation for the attack. An Australian citizen was among the 7 people killed in the Israeli strike on the vehicles carrying aid workers from the World Central Kitchen NGO.
We need to have accountability for how it's occurred. And what isn't good enough is the statements that have been made, including that this is just a product of war.
The founder of World Central Kitchen has accused Israel of systematically targeting his workers when it carried out the strike. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the workers were killed unintentionally. The incident has prompted World Central Kitchen to suspend its operations in Gaza, where Palestinians are desperate for food and other necessities. Several other relief organizations have also now stopped supplying aid in the Gaza Strip. This comes as rights groups say Gaza is inching towards famine.
Transporting the bodies of aid workers. They were killed in an Israeli airstrike while overseeing the delivery of food aid in Gaza. The U.S.-based NGO released the names and photos of Palestinian, Australian, British, Polish, and U.S.-Canadian staff killed in the attack. The remains of six were taken out of Gaza to Egypt to be repatriated to their home countries. The founder of the charity, World Central Kitchen, said the convoy was targeted systematically, one car after the other.
They were targeting us in the conflicting zone, in an area controlled by IDF, them knowing that was our teams moving on that route, seven people dead, but there are seven on top of a list of more than another 190 humanitarian workers that they've been killed over the last 6 months.
Israel's government said it regrets the incident and promised to ensure it would not happen again. But its conduct in the war has come under mounting criticism, not just abroad, but also at home.
The United States has authorized a multi-billion dollar weapons package for Israel, according to several media reports. It comes as President Joe Biden publicly acknowledged the pain being felt by Arab Americans over the war in Gaza. He has also faced criticism by some in his own Democratic Party. The decision follows a visit by Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant to Washington this week. The new arms package is meant to include 1,800 of the most destructive bombs used in Gaza. The White House declined to comment.
We look forward to a great discussion.
Jared Feierstein is with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and is a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. I asked him how badly he thinks Israel needs these weapons.
Well, the issue, of course, is that some of the weapons that are included, are the munitions that are included in the package, according to the press reports, are these 2,000-pound bombs that the Israelis have been using in their Gaza campaign that allegedly are the source of some of the mass casualty events that we've seen over the course of the past several months. And so the Israelis are clearly using them, and there are a lot of people who are unhappy about the use and will be unhappy that the administration is sending more.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this listener-funded program, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show, which is supplied without cost to more than 100 radio stations across the globe. We will conclude with France 24. Members of the UK Parliament have called for a suspension of arms sales to Israel, and the majority of the population want a ban enacted. An international press review on the murder of the food aid volunteers in Gaza, and the result that charities have halted their Gaza missions. Then a report on the Israeli military use of artificial intelligence to generate targets, labeling 37,000 Palestinian men as members of Hamas or jihadist operatives. France 24.
More pressure on the UK to stop selling arms to Israel. After three British nationals were killed from an airstrike in Gaza while volunteering for an aid provider. As a response, the Liberal Democrats and Scottish National Party called for arms exports to Israel to be suspended. Labour said lawyers first need to find that Israel has broken international law.
I have now been calling for 12 days for David Cameron to publish the legal advice so that we are clear on whether Israel has contravened international humanitarian law and therefore arms sales should be suspended.
A Guardian poll found a majority of people in Britain back a ban on weapon sales to Israel. Sales which have amounted to £570 million since 2008. Exports include components for explosive devices, assault rifles, and military aircraft, which were about 0.4% of Britain's total global defence sales in 2022. Israel isn't the only partner the UK has come under scrutiny for selling weapons to. Activists have protested Britain's supply of arms to Saudi Arabia, totalling up to £29 billion since 2015, according to Campaign Against Arms Trade, an NGO that has accused Saudi Arabia of breaching international humanitarian law in Yemen.
Review for you now. It sees us go back to one of our top stories, that international aid workers killed by that Israeli drone strike. Leo McGuinn is joining us. Three of them, Leo, were British. So what's been the reaction in the UK newspapers?
Yeah, that news very much dominating the UK front pages this morning. The news that an Israeli drone strike killed seven international aid workers. As you say, three of them were British. This is the front of the Mirror this morning, killed trying to feed starving kids. You can see the image of one of the cars, one of the three cars that was struck by the strikes. The Times have this: "I outcry at aid worker deaths." Photo of three of the workers on the front. Brit Jim Henderson, Australian Zomi Francom and Pole Delina Soboy, just three of the seven killed. The Telegraph lead with the fact that British Prime Minister, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, has demanded answers over the airstrike. Their lead is the fact that Sunak has spoken to Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu. He said he's appalled by what happened and expects a thorough investigation. Let's move across to The Guardian. They report that charities have halted their Gazan missions following the death. This Guardian article speculates that this will lead to a worsening humanitarian situation. Aid ships organised by WCK arrived in Gaza on Monday carrying 400 tonnes of food and supplies, enough for 1 million meals, but only 100 tonnes of that was able to be distributed before the charity ordered the vessels carrying the remaining aid to return to Cyprus.
That's the British reaction then, Leo. What about the Israeli one? How are the strikes being reported there?
Yeah, I'll start by showing you Haaretz, a rather left-leaning newspaper. They've often been critical of Benjamin Netanyahu. They have the news on their front page. They published harrowing details of the strike, citing defence sources. According to the report, an Israeli drone fired three missiles, one after the other, hitting the armoured cars, which were clearly displayed with the charity's logo on them because of a suspicion that a militant was travelling with them, despite the fact that the suspect did not leave the warehouse with the rest of the group. The cars were hit as they travelled back along a route that was predetermined with the IDF. Criticism for Haaretz isn't unusual, but what is unusual is Israel Hayom. They are a paper owned by a good friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. They've often been criticised for being a mouthpiece of the Israeli government, but they do have that news on the front page this morning. They describe it as an incident. They report on President Biden's preaching on Israel's obligation to protect humanitarians in Gaza. They also have a quote from Netanyahu: "This happens in wartime," the PM says, adding that there will be a full investigation so as to avoid such incidents in the future.
We turn first to France 24's Lila Jacinto. Lila, what more do we know about what exactly transpired on Monday?
I mean, a lot of questions being asked, and we heard the Israeli military chief there in a very preliminary response saying that it was a misidentification that happened with the killings. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday said that it was they were unidentified and airstrikes. I mean, clearly at the heart of this is clearly a collapse of command and control. And some of these questions have actually been addressed by a joint investigative report by the Israeli-Palestinian news site Plus972 with a Hebrew language local call. And this investigative report, which is based on speaking to many Israeli military intelligence officials, the findings were shared with the British daily The Guardian. Basically, what this report looks at is the Israeli military's use of artificial intelligence, AI, to generate targets. The system, the Israeli system, is called Lavender. And at its height, apparently, after the October 7th attacks, Lavender generated 37,000 Palestinian men identified as either Hamas or PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, operatives. And one of the people there said, yes, this is 37,000, but it depends on how you set the bar for how you define a Hamas or a PIJ operative. And the Israeli left-leaning daily, Haaretz, has another report where it talks about kill zones. And they have quoted Israeli reservists as saying, basically, the military right now is defining anyone who it kills as a terrorist, anyone, any Palestinian adult male who walks into these zones that are called kill zones that the Israeli military has identified, but which Palestinians are not made aware of, which are not clearly marked. Now, the IDF, of course, denies these claims. It denies that, you know, that it's using excessive force. Proportionality is the heart of it. And it's also the question of collateral damage, because what is happening with these AI-generated names and targets? If they are identified as low-level operatives, then the military is using dumb bombs, not smart bombs, which increases the collateral damage. Now, if you take the example of the aid workers who were killed, there were seven of them, there were three strikes, assuming, which is not the case, of course, that there was a Hamas operative in the car, unbeknownst to them, which is absolutely not the case. Does that justify taking out seven other civilians? Mm. So, you know, so this is all really undermining the credibility of the IDF figures and what the IDF is saying. Because among other things, in 6 months now, this war that has entered, the IDF says it has killed 13,000 Hamas or PIJ operatives. Now, health officials in Gaza, in the Hamas-run Gaza, says that the 33,000 death tolls does not include 13,000 adult males. They have consistently said that most of the casualties are women and children. For the world watching this, one is the credibility of the Israeli military, which is coming down. Two, the world is also watching the outcry with leaders like Joe Biden, Rishi Sunak, and the media coverage that this is getting. They are clearly seeing images of those three passports, the EU, British, Australian passport, that is generating this outcry, that is making demands for accountability, and asking themselves, what about the nearly 200 Palestinian aid workers who have been killed in the 6 months? And this is really regenerating this narrative, which is so profound in this during this conflict, of the double standards and the lack of accountability that some have and others don't.
Those reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of US and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 27th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 26 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I am recuperating from spinal surgery, I am staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.